populations with high levels of obesity, according to a report linking overweight populations with more severe coronavirus-related illness and mortality. The report by the World Obesity Federation found that 88% of deaths due to COVID-19 in the first year of the pandemic were in countries where more than half of the population is classified as overweight, which it defines as having a body mass index, BMI, above 25. Obesity, generally defined as BMI above 30, is associated with particularly severe outcomes. Among the nations with overweight populations above the 50% threshold were also those with some of the largest proportions of coronavirus deaths, including countries such as Britain, Italy, and the United States. Some 2.5 million people have died around the world of COVID-19, and more than 517,000 of which were in the United States. U.S. bishops divided on the morality of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, by Jacqueline Pizer and Michelle Borstein. More Catholic bishops weighed in Wednesday on the morality of coronavirus vaccines, offering at times conflicting guidance to the nation's 50 million Catholics. Some have urged them to take any available vaccine, while others said they should avoid the newly approved Johnson & Johnson shot because it was made using abortion-derived cells. One bishop said the vaccine was morally compromised and forbidden. The Vatican first sought to counsel Catholics about the coronavirus vaccines in December when its Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith declared it morally acceptable to take ones that relied on cell lines from aborted fetuses in their research and production when ethically irreproachable COVID-19 vaccines are not available. Pope Francis has since taken the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, and last month the governor of Vatican City said employees who don't take a vaccine could be sanctioned or fired. We still have a bit of time, so I'm going to turn to a longer article than those that we have read so far. This one was from the Washington Post. CDC says states should prioritize people with disabilities as they broaden vaccine access. J&J's one-shot vaccine might be desirable for people who move frequently and for prisoners and people who are in homeless shelters, the agency advises. By Lena H. Sun, published March 2nd. With the nationwide demand for coronavirus shots continuing to far outstrip supply, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said Tuesday states should consider prioritizing people with disabilities or cognitive decline as officials broaden access to vaccines. The guidance is part of the agency's latest recommendations for administering doses now that three vaccines are authorized and recommended for use to combat COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Any of the three can be used during these initial phases when supply is sharply limited, officials say. The newest addition to the pandemic arsenal, the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine that does not need to be kept frozen, might be best for people who want to be immunized quickly or would have difficulty returning for a second shot. The other two authorized vaccines, one from pharmaceutical giant Pfizer and German biotech company BioNTech, and the other from U.S. biotech firm Moderna, require two doses. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine may be most suitable for people who move frequently or those who live and work in homeless shelters or correctional facilities, the CDC said. Experts noted that the latest guidance reflects more attention to the real-world challenges that have surfaced throughout the country, as many people who are prioritized for the shots are unable to make appointments online. States and localities have adopted widely differing approaches, resulting in a patchwork of guidelines governing who should get early access to the vaccines as more transmissible and possibly more dangerous variants circulate in this country. State officials announce changes to these priorities frequently, causing further confusion. Many older adults designated as the highest priority for inoculation have been unable to register for vaccinations because of glitchy online systems or lack of internet access. That has often left children and grandchildren spending hours hunting for appointments. Volunteer groups and individuals have sprung into action to help in some cases, while technology columnists have offered advice on strategies to master vaccine websites. There is growing concern about reaching those who may face unique barriers to access, people who are disabled, those in congregant settings outside of long-term care facilities, and those who have technological or geographic barriers, said Jennifer Cates, a senior vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has been tracking how states have prioritized groups for vaccination. Whether states will follow this guidance remains to be seen, she added. The guidance gives flexibility to local officials, and many real-world care providers would really welcome this, said Jean Morazzo, the director of the Infectious Diseases Division at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. The potential downside, she said, is that it does not provide as much specificity as some might like when supply is scarce and many people are clamoring for a first dose and assurances they will get their second. The solution to all this debate is to get more vaccine out there, period, she said. We don't have time to quibble about the nuances of who deserves to get it first. The latest CDC guidance urges states to consider the unique needs of people with disabilities or cognitive decline and their caretakers, and those with limited access to technology as appointments open to new groups. After healthcare workers and nursing home staff and residents, the CDC Vaccine Advisory Panel has recommended that the next priority groups include adults 65 and older, essential workers, and those 16 to 64 with medical conditions that put them at high risk for severe cases of COVID-19. Many states are already vaccinating those 65 and older. Fewer states have begun inoculating those with high-risk conditions. Advocates for people with disabilities say the updated guidance is a step in the right direction, but does not go far enough. It doesn't resolve the overall uncertainty and lack of clarity for people with disabilities and their families, said Peter V. Burns, chief executive officer for the ARC of the United States, which advocates for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The implementation guidance said the easier-to-use Johnson & Johnson vaccine might be the best fit for certain populations. Because it does not have to be frozen, it can be used in mobile clinics or sites that do not have freezer capacity and may be desirable for mobile populations or populations with high turnover, such as homeless shelters or correctional facilities. One of every five prisoners in state and federal corrections facilities has tested positive for the coronavirus, a rate more than four times that of the general population, according to data collected by the Associated Press and the Marshall Project. In some states, more than half of prisoners have been infected. It's not just that the COVID-19 virus spreads faster behind bars, it's that the pre-existing medical conditions that make COVID-19 more dangerous are more common behind bars. Not to mention that you have people in prison working jobs like the kitchen and the laundry room that are essential to the prison itself being able to function, said Wanda Bertram, a spokeswoman for the Prison Policy Initiative, a nonprofit research and advocacy group for criminal justice reform. And that looks like we're at time for this day of our coronavirus update. This Thursday, March 4th, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Remember that our coronavirus update now airs three times at first, 4:30 in the afternoon, and then the next day at 1:30 a.m. and then 8:30 a.m. As always, thank you for being with us. Be well and have a great day. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Blindness and Disability News Hour, followed by Western Magazines at 11.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 70 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 10 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the Blindness and Disability News Hour from Mind's Eye Radio. This program covers the week of February 28, 2021, which means by the time you're listening to it, it's March. Came in like a lamb this year, which is good for us now. At the end of the month, we'll see. But anyway, thanks for joining us today. Hope everybody is doing well, staying safe and staying in and getting your shots if you're eligible. We've got lots of interesting information for you this week, so grab a cup of coffee, cup of tea, whatever drink suits your fancy, and let's see what's going on in the world today. Our first story comes from National Public Radio and Illinois Public Media from Health News from NPR. This is posted on March 1st, is written by Christine Herman and Dana Cronin. To help farm workers get COVID-19 test and vaccine, we must build trust and a safety net. With more than 20 million acres of corn and soybeans, Illinois is among the top U.S. producers of both of these crops. To make it all happen, the state relies on thousands of farm workers, some who travel to the state for seasonal work, and others, like 35-year-old Sarai, who call Illinois home. Being an agricultural worker, quote, is the most beautiful thing, unquote, Sarai says in an interview in Spanish. NPR agreed to identify her only by her first name because she's undocumented. Sarai has spent much of the past decade cultivating crops in central Illinois, and moved from Mexico to the U.S. to find work that would allow her to better support her family. Since the onset of the pandemic, she spent most of her time shepherding her three kids through their virtual school classes. There have been tens of thousands of COVID-19 cases and hundreds of deaths reported among U.S. farm workers and meat plant workers. Because there isn't an official tracking system in place, these figures, based largely on media reports, are likely an undercount. And yet, agricultural workers like Sarai struggle to get access to the most basic tool to fight the spread of the coronavirus, testing. Sarai, for example, has only been tested once since the start of the pandemic. The nearest testing site is the next town over, and without a car of her own or a public transportation option, she had to borrow a friend's vehicle to get there. She hasn't gotten COVID-19, but Sarai knows many others who've gotten sick. She says the pandemic has made the past year a sad and difficult one. Quote, many farm workers are both working and living in sometimes isolated rural regions of the country, unquote, says Diana Telefson-Torres, executive director of the California-based United Farm Workers Foundation. In addition to living far from testing sites, these workers often lack access to reliable information in their native language and have a general mistrust of the healthcare system. And missing work to get a test or to isolate or quarantine could be financially devastating. While the rollout of the coronavirus vaccine provides some hope for a better future, the virus is still spreading across the U.S., and efforts to expand access to testing and build trust with communities of farm workers are still needed, Telefson-Torres says. She says these efforts will also be critical for ensuring that these hard-to-reach, vulnerable populations have access to the vaccine when the time comes. Leverage long-standing community connections. Early in the pandemic, Gilberto Rosas, an anthropologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, was struck by how easy it was for him, a work-from-home professor, to get a test compared to other workers in nearby towns who were more vulnerable to catching the virus and developing a severe case of COVID-19. Rosas works in Champaign-Urbana, which has its own mass testing program for university students and employees. The campus is just 15 miles south of the village of Rantoul, where outbreaks at a meat processing plant and a hotel housing migrant farm workers were among the worst in the county last year. Quote, we can walk down two flights of stairs, go out the back door, and we can get testing, Rosas says. Whereas these people who are at the forefront, who work in the fields, who work in the plants, they lack that kind of access, unquote. Rosars is part of a team at the University of Illinois that had set out to study what was causing the virus to spread among members of the agricultural community. They decided to do something to address the issue of testing access. Quote, we want to both unearth inequalities, but also mitigate them, unquote, Rosas says. The researchers teamed up with medical professionals from clinics in the area to organize pop-up coronavirus testing events in Rantoul. The events are advertised in English and Spanish. The group has also tried to leverage long-standing community connections to bolster turnout, reaching out to churches and organizations that cater to the area's immigrant and agricultural workforce. Even with that outreach, they've been frustrated by low attendance at many of their testing events. At one event held before Christmas outside a community center, for example, only 15 people came to get a test. Four of those 15 tested positive, a very high rate. Structural barriers, financial and immigration worries. Sophia Bolanos-Robinette suspects the reason more people don't turn out for coronavirus testing, even when it's available at convenient times and locations, is because a positive test can be financially devastating. Bolanos-Robinette has worked with farm workers for the past 10 years, most recently as an advocate for migrant students in the Illinois Migrant Education Program. She recently joined Rosas and other University of Illinois anthropologists to study issues like barriers to testing. She recalls helping last summer with a coronavirus testing effort aimed at farm workers who travel to the region for seasonal work. The clinic tried to make it as easy as possible for the workers to attend by setting up a station during off hours right outside the migrant housing area. Quote, but some of them said they didn't even want to take the test because, in the case they got back a positive result, they would have to stop working, Bolanos-Robinette says. And then that means for them they will not get any money for at least 2 weeks, unquote. That's a big deal, she says, especially for farm workers who earn the bulk of their yearly income doing this seasonal work. For low-wage farm workers, quote, every penny counts, unquote, says Telefsins Torres of the United Farm Workers Foundation. In the most recent National Agricultural Workers Survey, one-third of farm workers reported family incomes below the poverty line. Simply put, they have no safety net. Quote, when you have to worry about putting food on your own table for your family, sometimes that is the focus because there isn't another option, unquote, Telefsins Torres says. For those agricultural workers who are undocumented, she says, there are even more disincentives to get tested. They may worry that seeking a coronavirus test could jeopardize their efforts to obtain a visa, which is not true, but is a common misperception. And after years of the Trump administration being more aggressive with immigration enforcement, Telefsins Torres says, there's a huge lack of trust and a real fear of deportation. Despite lower than ideal turnout at the pop-up testing events in Rantoul, University of Illinois anthropologist Ellen Moody says attempts to host, quote, a few small-scale testing events, irregularly scheduled and located in different sites, unquote, have made a difference for the handfuls of people who might not otherwise have known that they had the virus. However, Moody says, the U.S. needs a comprehensive strategy to address the virus and protect vulnerable workers. Many public health experts have been calling for such a strategy since the start of the pandemic. So far, President Joe Biden has made that a priority of his administration. In a document published January 20th, his inaugural day in office, Biden outlined a COVID-19 strategy that focused on boosting the production and distribution of vaccines. His plan includes efforts to address supply shortfalls for testing materials, implement stronger worker safety guidelines, expand emergency paid leave, and otherwise strengthen the social service safety net. Vaccine implications. Mistrust breeds skepticism. Building trust with members of the agricultural worker community remains critical, Telefsins Torres says, not just to get more people to show up for testing, but also to show up for the vaccine as soon as they are eligible. At a recent virtual town hall event hosted by the United Farm Workers Foundation, Telefson Torres says she has heard from many farm workers across the United States who are eager to get the vaccine, but others have reservations. The biggest concern she's heard has been about the potential cost, especially for the many workers who lack health insurance. Telefson Torres says her organization is working on getting the word out that the vaccine is free for everyone. Others, she says, worry about vaccine safety, asking questions like, what is this vaccine? What does it contain? What are you putting in my body? Vaccine safety is something Sarai, the farm worker in Illinois, worries about too. After finding some information online, she grew concerned about the possibility of adverse reactions. So, at least for now, she is not planning to get the COVID-19 vaccine. However, Sarai says, if someone she trusts shows her evidence the vaccine is safe, she could change her mind. In Illinois, food and agricultural workers are now eligible for the vaccine. Public Health Administrator Julie Pride says the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, which serves Champaign County, including the village of Rantoul, plans to work with a federally supported migrant clinic to host mobile vaccination events targeting migrant and seasonal farm workers. Telefson Torres says partnerships like that will be critical to ensure that agricultural workers, who have faced so many challenges throughout the pandemic, have equitable access to the vaccine, their best hope of staying healthy. Quote, the norms that we have seen prior to the pandemic of not prioritizing worker health or just basic safety net needs need to be addressed both by state, local, federal governments, and employers, she says. We're literally talking about a life and death situation here, unquote. And this story was reported in collaboration with Side Effects Public Media, Harvest Public Media, and the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, and is a part of a reporting partnership that includes Illinois Public Media, NPR, and Kaiser Health News. As we continue with this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour, let's turn to a blog from the good folks at Google called The Keyword and their accessibility department. You can find them online at blog.google.com. How Project Guideline Gave Me the Freedom to Run Solo. And this is written by Thomas Panik, President and CEO for Guiding Eyes for the Blind. This was published on November 19th of 2020. And it's opened by, or introduced by, this word from the editor. At Google Research, we're interested in exploring how technology can help improve people's daily lives and experiences. So it's been an incredible opportunity to work with Thomas Panik, avid runner and president and CEO of Guiding Eyes for the Blind, to apply computer vision for something important in his everyday life, independent exercise. Project Guideline is an early-stage research project that leverages on-device machine learning to allow Thomas to use a phone, headphones, and a guideline painted on the ground to run independently. And in the following story, Thomas shares why he collaborated with us on this research project and what the journey has been like for him. I've always loved to run. Ever since I was a boy, running has made me feel free. But when I was 8 years old, I noticed I couldn't see the leaves on a tree so well, and that the stars in the night sky began to slowly disappear. And then they did forever. By the time I was a young adult, I was diagnosed as legally blind due to a genetic condition. I had to rely on a cane or a canine to guide me. For years, I gave up running. Then I heard about running with human guides, and I decided to give it a try. It gave me a sense of belonging, holding a tether and following the guide runner in front of me. I even qualified for the New York City and Boston marathons 5 years in a row. But as grateful as I was to my human guides, I wanted more independence. So in 2019, I decided to run the first half marathon assisted only by guide dogs. But I know it's not possible for everyone to have a brilliant, fast companion like my guide dog Blaze, I run an organization called Guiding Eyes for the Blind, and we work tirelessly to help people with vision loss receive running guide dogs that can help them live more active and independent lives. The problem is that there are millions more people with vision loss than there are available guide dogs. So I started asking a question. What would be possible to help guide a blind runner independently? In the fall of 2019, I asked that question to a group of designers and technologists at a Google hackathon. I wasn't anticipating much more than an interesting conversation, but by the end of the day, they'd built a rough demo that allowed a phone to recognize a line taped to the ground and give audio cues to me when I walked with Blaze. We were excited and hopeful to see if we could develop it into something more. We began by sketching out how the prototype would work, settling on a simple concept. I'd wear a phone on a waistband and bone-conducting headphones. The phone's camera would look for a physical guideline on the ground and send audio signals depending on my position. If I drifted to the left of the line, the sound would get louder and more dissonant in my left ear. If I drifted to the right, the same thing would happen, but in my right ear. After a few months, we were ready to test it on an indoor oval track. After a few adjustments, I was able to run 8 laps. It was a short distance, and with all my Google teammates close by, but it was the first unguided mile that I had run in decades. Our next step was to see if the tech could work where I love running most, in the peace and serenity of a park. This brought a whole new batch of challenges to work through, variables in weather and lighting conditions, and the need for new data to train the model, for starters. After months of building an on-device machine learning model to accurately detect the guidelines in different environments, the team was finally ready to test the tech outside for the first time. I've been waiting 25 years to run outdoors on my own. I stood at the start of the guideline, hopping up and down in excitement. When the team gave me the go-ahead, I began sprinting on my toes, as fast as my legs could carry me, down the hill and around a gentle bend in the road. As I tightened my form, my stride was getting more confident and longer with every step. I felt free, like I was effortlessly running through the clouds. When I arrived at the finish line, I was completely overcome with emotion. My wife Melissa and my kids hugged me. My guide dog Blaze licked the salt off my hand. They were happy for me too. For the first time in a lifetime, I didn't feel like a blind man. I felt free. Today, we're testing this technology further. I'll be attempting to run NYRR's Virtual Run for Thanks 5K along a line temporarily painted in Central Park in New York City. I want to thank NYRR, the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation, Central Park Conservancy, the NYPD, the New York City Department of Sanitation, and the New York City Department of Transportation for helping to make this 5K run possible. We want to see how the system works in urban environments, just one of the many challenges to complete before it can be used more widely. Collaborating on this project helped me realize that a personal dream of mine. I'm so grateful to the Google team and whoever came up with the idea of a hackathon in the first place. I hope there will be more runs with Project Guideline in my future and for many other runners as well. By sharing the story of how this project got started and how the tech works today, we hope to start new conversations with the larger blind and low vision community about how and if this technology might be useful for them too. As we continue our research, we hope to gather feedback from more organizations and explore painting guidelines in their communities. To learn more, please visit goo.gll/projectguideline. That's goo.gle/projectguideline. For our next story on this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour, we're going to turn to the American Council of the Blind and their March 2021 Blind or Braille Forum. And three quick little short stories having to do with low vision experiences. And what follows is a number of short stories about people's experiences with low vision and its challenges. And we warn you that you should put down your favorite beverage before you read the second story. You'll understand why after we read it. First up, a low vision tutorial. What does it mean to have low vision? Few things regarding low vision are absolute. What can be said that is universal? There are many diagnoses and degrees of vision, but there is little understanding of low vision. One area that is often overlooked is that there is an increased requirement for visual interpretation that every low vision person must employ. It can be the visual land of the unknown until mental evaluation illuminates what one's eyes are physically relaying. A true story comes to mind. Back in the day, a friend and her boyfriend, both young and visually impaired, were out walking to the local grocery. Each day they would follow the same route and view a gas station in the near distance. There was something strange that caught their eye. It appeared that there were two men standing at the corner of the station. Why were they always there? Was this an indication of some kind of illegal activity? They decided reasonably to avoid the area. Eventually, their curiosity got the better of them, and they decided to investigate. When they arrived at the gas station for a closer look, they found that the two men standing at the corner were actually two innocuous phone booths. The conclusion we can reach can be off base or spot on, tragic or humorous, as noted above. Welcome to the world of those with low vision, a world where every day is an adventure. And that was written by Valerie Reese Lerman of Sacramento, California. And now the second story that we warned you about. This is written by Gene Donovan of Haverhill, Massachusetts. It's called That's Not Powdered Sugar. A few years ago, I was given a chinchilla in trade for some work that I did for a friend. And this is a live chinchilla as a pet. We named him Chewy because he looked a little bit like the Star Wars character, and he was a delight. They are not supposed to get wet, as it's not good for their fur. So they take dust baths where they roll around in chinchilla dust to keep their fur clean and shiny. I was making cupcakes, so I asked my husband to go to the pet shop to purchase a bag of dust. I asked my son to put it upstairs and thought no more about it. I was concentrating on making frosting, so I reached in the cupboard for the confectioner's sugar. It was a new bag, so I opened it and dumped some in my bowl with the butter. I tasted it, and it didn't seem sweet at all, so I dumped in more sugar. I tried it again, and it was still bland as it could be. I started sputtering at the bowl when my son appeared and started killing himself laughing. I didn't see anything funny as my son continued to laugh. Well, I had opened the chinchilla dust and was dumping it into my bowl instead of confectioner's sugar because both products came in a plastic bag and they both feel about the same. My son hadn't taken the bag of dust upstairs. He put it in the kitchen cupboard. He wanted to go outside to play, so he thought he'd retrieve it later and no one would be the wiser. He was definitely wrong. That gave my family something to laugh about for years, especially if I said I was making a batch of cupcakes. And finally, another look at low vision. It is always fun meeting new people. That is, of course, unless you are in a crowded store looking for your spouse. Does that shirt look familiar? The color, the design? That's got to be him. Well, hi, honey. No, not him. Oh, sorry, I thought you were my husband. Your husband? What? You mistook me for... Are you blind? Drunk? Just plain crazy? Well, no, I'm just legally blind. Legally what? That's right, legally blind. And the looks that come to their faces. Then the explanation starts. I can see the big things, not the smaller ones. This works very well if you are, in fact, not addressing someone that is, shall we say, obese. Can't see details? No, I can't drive. The driving part they can relate to, and the light of recognition starts to register. Then there's the fun at the office. Is that my work buddy Laura in the red top coming my way? That must be her, because I saw her closer up wearing that color earlier. I better not seem rude. I'll say, hi Laura, as I pass. It's not her. My explanation, yes, I've had plenty of practice. The possibilities for social misunderstandings are many. That is why I decided to use a white cane. You can't see, I get a lot. Or sometimes someone will actually come right out and accuse me of faking it. Once again, the explanation. Don't get me wrong, I don't mind educating people. That is, if they are open to honest communication on the subject. Often, though, they seem to have already made up their minds, made their assumptions, and come to their conclusions. That is why I so much welcome those that come right out and ask questions. Every low-vision individual has a story to tell. A different story, it's true, but one with similarities that we all share. And that was written by Valerie Reese Lerman. For our next story, we're going to turn to hashtag MyBlindStory, which is a blog site managed by blindnewworld.org. And this week's story comes from Alex Gray, who is a candidate for the at-large Boston City Council, and it was posted on February 24th of 2021. My vision for a better Boston. When I was very young, I knew I was going to grow up to be the next great Boston sports athlete. I was thinking Mo Vaughn or Drew Bledsoe. Mind you, this was back when we loved our teams, but they never won anything. My dreams changed when I was 8 years old and I began to lose my vision. It started in my left eye and then moved to my right. By the time I reached middle school, my dream of playing professional sports came to a sharp end. For most of the next few years, I found myself navigating a world without sight, but also really without purpose. I missed being part of a team, something larger than just me. I missed the feeling that comes with working with others to achieve a larger goal. I most missed the dignity that comes from doing what you love and loving what you do. That feeling that gets you out of bed early in the morning, that feeling of belonging. Getting back in the game. One day, in freshman year of high school, things began to change for me. I randomly found myself talking sports with the head football coach at my high school, Coach Ken McPhee. He invited me to come to practice. I'll never know what motivated Coach that day, but I will always remember that as the moment I found my dignity again. No longer did I compete on the field, but that day I became part of a team again. I spent the next 4 years attending every practice and game and tracking everything we did. I gave the coaches something they never really had, a manager who organized all of their work in a format which allowed them to quickly refer back to a play or a statistic. Coach saw me as someone who knew sports and as someone who could contribute. The first thing I did as a college student was to call and submit my name for a position to help the football team, and I waited excitedly to hear back. I waited and I waited. Finally, a friend who was a player on the team told me what was really going on. The person in charge of hiring expressed concern about a blind person being around a football team, and what he thought was the inherent danger of such a thing. So, there it was. Without an actual interview or even a brief conversation, I was not being considered. I was viewed as a liability and not as an actual person. An opportunity that changed the game. But as one door seemingly closed, a friend brought me into the Appalachia Volunteer Corps, a club that organized spring break service opportunities throughout the Appalachian region of America. Before I knew it, I was on a bus to Virginia. The next week could completely change my college experience, the direction of my life, and fundamentally reshape the way I thought of the world and my role in it. I spent 7 days with 40 strangers from my college, sleeping on the floor of a closed dance club. We went throughout the area, meeting community members and helping out folks with odd jobs like raking leaves, painting fences, and sometimes just spending time talking with people who were different than us. They let us in onto their lives and the dreams that they had for their families. They also shared with us the fears and challenges their community faced. I saw dignity in so many forms, so many people of all different ages, shapes, and sizes. The trip gave me perspective on what the world needed and began to show me how I could help to provide just a small bit of that need. It was the trip that motivated me to apply for an internship at the State House during my sophomore year of college and then continue to work in public service. After graduation, I fought for progressive housing solutions with the Massachusetts Housing and Shelter Alliance. When I worked for Governor Patrick, I served as the point person between the governor's office and the Office of Transportation and Public Safety. And for the past 5 years, I've worked for Mayor Walsh in the city's Office of Workforce Development in every neighborhood and employment sector imaginable. I was honored to be asked to help spearhead a tuition-free community college plan for the city of Boston. I visited dozens of schools throughout the city and met with students, teachers, and school staffs. After 3 years, we put over 500 BPS students into this program. In my capacity in this office, I learned that the statistics are often grim when we talk about the economic mobility of people with disabilities. For a community estimated to make up about 20% of the population, the long-term poverty rate of people with the disability is over 3 times higher than other demographic minorities. And the ability for people with disabilities to pull themselves out of poverty is so hard and seemingly impossible for some. In 2019, only 2 out of every 10 people with disabilities were in our labor force, a rate 3 times lower than any other marginalized population. If you care about economic justice, then you must also care about disability justice. I am running for office because I want to give a voice to the approximately 140,000 people with disabilities in Boston. I think people with disabilities want and deserve to have someone who is shared in their experience that looks like them in the conversation amongst elected officials. I think it is so crucial that we start to include conversations about people with disabilities not just in a silo, but in the larger policy and diversity conversation. The older I get, the more I think about dignity. It is one of the few things in life that can't be taken away. So, in my life and in this campaign, helping others find dignity in their work and in their lives, no matter who they are and what background they come from, will always be a top value for me each and every day. Ultimately, I'm running because what I think we need more and more in this world are good listeners. In observing videos of me as a kid, I am quite sure that if I did not lose my sight, I would be terrible at listening. But now I consider myself an expert listener because I've had to be. People tell me all the time whether it is when they call to resolve a cell phone bill or they are at a doctor's appointment, they often feel they are not listened to. I pledge that if elected, I will be the best listener the Boston City Council has ever had. In my campaign, I want to try to reach out to all people from all backgrounds and all corners of the city because I have seen so many times in my life that there is so much potential lying right below the surface. So many people just need to be asked in order for them to step up and pitch in. Everyone has potential to contribute if they are treated with dignity. And Alex Gray is running to become a Boston City Councilor and, if elected, would be the only blind elected official in Massachusetts. He is a graduate of Boston College and Suffolk University Law School and lives in Jamaica Plain with his wife, Lauren. Alex is on the board of the Friends of the Jamaica Plain Library and an active member of the Boston Bar Association, serving on their diversity, equity, and inclusion section. And as we're about halfway through this week's program, we'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Blindness and Disability News Hour from Mind's Eye Radio. This program covers the week of February 28th, 2021. And let's continue with this week's program by visiting another blog site, The Voice of the Nation's Blind, which is operated by the National Federation of the Blind. You can find them online at nfb.org. And a blog post that went online on Monday, March 1st, So Much More Than the Money, a scholarship story. 20 years ago, in July of 2001, I was privileged to be one among a group of 30 winners who received National Federation of the Blind scholarships at our national convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was 17, had just graduated high school, and at the time had absolutely no concept of how that experience would affect the course of the next two decades of my life. For the past 4 years, I have served as chairperson of the NFB Scholarship Committee, and as we approach the 20th anniversary of my own award, I can't help but reflect on how the most significant part of that experience had nothing to do with the dollar amount on the scholarship check I received. For the past several years, I have submitted an article to the Braille Monitor entitled "The Secret to Winning a National Federation of the Blind Scholarship." The article debunked some myths that are often circulated regarding the scholarship process and offered some tips for students regarding best practices for submitting high-quality applications. There is, however, one last secret the article addressed only briefly, which is that the process of applying for the scholarship and the experience of being a winner are the true prizes above and beyond the financial award. The rewards of the scholarship experience begin with the application. Each year at our national convention, the banquet closes with a ceremony which 30 blind students from across the 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico are awarded scholarships, ranging in value from $3,000 to $12,000 in recognition of their academic aptitude and demonstrated leadership qualities. While the attention and admiration of the Federation focuses on these deserving individuals, and speculation about who will win the top scholarship amounts always runs high, it is worth mentioning that behind these 30 winners are several hundred applicants who may not have come away with a check, but who have participated in an experience that has the potential to help them grow personally and professionally. Each year, the NFB scholarship program receives many times the number of applications than we have scholarships to award. As a result, many winners have applied more than once before being selected. Through the years, as these students, undaunted, continue to submit their evolving applications, we have the privilege to observe them grow and develop as scholars, as leaders, and as individuals. Some of this growth comes from the dedication and perseverance required to complete the scholarship process and the accompanying interview with an NFB affiliate president. Our youngest applicants gain experience through this process, and that can be applied to their college and career advancement as they take on the responsibility of gathering and submitting all the required application components. Our more experienced applicants gain the opportunity to reflect on their own sense of themselves as blind people and their impact on the world as they complete the essay and the president's interview. One of the most important goals of our national scholarship program is to find, recruit, and encourage new members. As our state scholarship chairs reach out to students in their states and our affiliate presidents conduct their individual interviews, hundreds of potential new leaders and members of our federation have the chance to get to know us for the first time each year. Even before the scholarship committee meets, these applicants have an opportunity to receive the gift of the federation, a gift that will last far longer than scholarship dollar amounts. For those applicants who are already familiar with and involved in the federation, the scholarship application process provides an excellent opportunity to deepen existing relationships with state presidents, as well as to take stock of their personal leadership experiences and the ways they themselves give back to the organization. For the 30 finalists, the scholarship committee selects annually. The announcement of the prizes on banquet night is only one facet of the award. During the NFB's national convention, which all finalists are required to attend in full, scholarship finalists have the opportunity to network with other blind students, to exchange information and ideas, and to meet and talk with hundreds of blind people who are successfully employed in many occupations and professions. Whether convention events take place in person or virtually, our past winners often comment that the money was quickly spent, but the contacts they made and the information they gathered at convention have continued to make their lives richer than they ever imagined. There is no dollar amount that can be assigned to the friendships that develop among the members of a scholarship class as they support one another during an action-packed week of getting to know the Federation and sharing their own accomplishments and goals with us. Likewise, there isn't a financial equivalent to the unprecedented access our finalists gain every year to the outstanding leaders who serve as members of the scholarship committee. Through discussions with these successful blind mentors, scholarship winners have an unequaled opportunity to get to know our organization's leaders by asking questions and discussing their own ideas and opinions. They also have the chance to make all of our Federation experiences more rich as they share their own diverse experiences and perspectives with us during the Board of Directors meeting and its student division events. When the gavel drops each year and convention draws to a close, the rewards of the scholarship program do not come to an end. Our winners continue to deepen their connections and maintain their collaboration with one another as they pursue their various academic degrees and professional goals. They continue to build relationships with the Federation through involvement with their state affiliates, strengthening and involving the foundations laid during those initial applicant interviews, and enriched during the week of the convention itself. Our winners develop and strengthen professional networks with other blind people in their chosen fields, and with members who share in their intersectional identities through the work of our divisions and groups. They serve on NABS boards, take on the work of the Federation and their affiliates, and carry what they have learned about the capacity of the blind into their schools, communities, and families. The scholarship checks are mailed and cashed in August, but the rewards of being an NFB scholarship recipient last for a lifetime. 20 years ago, when I won my NFB National Scholarship, I had previously had no direct exposure to the Federation. I sincerely expected to take the money and run, and did not go into the process with the hope of receiving anything more than some financial aid. Through the application process, I came to know my state affiliate president, who took the trouble then and in subsequent years to encourage my involvement in Federation work, to engage me in discussions and debates that broadened my understanding of myself as a blind person and my role in the NFB community. During the week of being a scholarship finalist, I laid the groundwork of friends and relationships with my classmates that I still maintain today. Many of these people have since taken on leadership roles in the Federation all across the country. I now serve as second vice president of the New York State affiliate of the NFB, president of the National Organization of Blind Educators, and as a scholarship chair, and it all started with the NFB scholarship. It is my sincere wish that as many blind students as possible can have the opportunity to engage in the scholarship process each year, as each step along the scholarship pathway brings with it tangible rewards, most of which will far exceed and outlast the financial benefits of a scholarship check. The 2021 application deadline is March 31st. If you are a legally blind student and will be enrolled full-time in a U.S. degree program in the fall of 2021, either in person or virtually, and are able to attend the annual convention of the National Federation of the Blind from July 6th through the 10th, I hope that you will grasp the same opportunity that I did 20 years ago and apply for one of the National Federation of the Blind scholarships. The benefits of engaging in the process will be yours for a lifetime. And that was written by Kate Mendez, National Federation of the Blind Scholarship Committee Chair. And the 2021 scholarship program details, checklist, application, and more can be found online at nfb.org/scholarships. As we continue with this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour, let's turn to the American Foundation for the Blind and Access World Magazine, the current issue thereof, and a story entitled Sight Tech Global, a New and Different Mainstream Accessibility Conference. And this article was written by J.J. Medaw. Assistive technology conferences have traditionally been planned from the inside, with their roots often steeped in the specialized technology companies that we've worked with for decades. But when a mainstream industry group, which included members from the startup-focused website TechCrunch, among many others, tackled the overarching topics involved with visual impairment and technology, a very much different perspective was shared. SightTech Global, owned by the Vista Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired in California, presented its first conference virtually this past December. The conference focused on the macro trends in technology and artificial intelligence and their intersection with assistive technology. Attendance was free. Panels included a discussion of autonomous vehicles, which included both leaders of blindness nonprofits and automobile manufacturers, and a discussion on AI bias, which tackled some of the pitfalls of using technology to make assumptions about people or objects. Where other events have recently focused on the now, SightTech Global focused on the future, both near and far, and frankly, this was a refreshing change. The attention to detail given to making the event accessible often exceeded that provided by traditional conferences in this space. First, the entire event was made available online for no cost, using YouTube to deliver the main content. All main stage and breakout sessions were live captioned, and it was evident that speakers were given training on best practices. For instance, many panelists would identify themselves whenever they spoke to help listeners associate voices with names. Transcripts for all main stage sessions were also made available, making it easier to more quickly peruse or pinpoint content after the event. And you can find that content online, and it's still up there, at sightechglobal.com. That's SightTechGlobal, all one word, .com. But beyond all this, the level of content and depth of conversation exceeded what many other events have provided in the past. Instead of simply giving a simple demo of a new app, designers were asked about the fine details and the tools used to create the leading technologies of today. Discussions were sometimes developer-focused and sometimes big-picture-focused, but presented in a way that allowed participants both inside and outside of the industry to learn from the content. People who were blind or visually impaired were generally portrayed as sophisticated individuals with a wide variety of needs and expectations. And I encourage you to delve into the conference sessions, but here are a few moments that caught my attention. And you can find all of that content, again, at sightechglobal.com. Let's hear about a conversation with Saqib Shaikh. Day one began with an interview of Microsoft's Saqib Shaikh, co-founder of Seeing AI. The Seeing AI app is one of the most popular tools for reading text, identifying food labels, and sorting currency. Shaikh spoke about the early days of the app, which was developed as an experiment at a 2014 hackathon. Through a lot of persistence and research and development, the app came to fruition a couple of years later. Seeing AI's development is based largely on user feedback. For example, developers learned that some people used the face recognition feature to identify the faces of United States presidents on paper money. This helped lead to the current currency recognition channel. The latest major update includes support for LiDAR, which stands for Light Detection and Ranging. Available on the iPhone 12 Pro and Pro Max, it uses augmented reality to place objects and landmarks in a three-dimensional field that can be heard while using headphones. This innovation could provide additional assistance while navigating, or serve as a better way to understand the layout of a room. Much further off in the future, the identification of a sequence of frames, in other words, describing streaming video, is something that the app may try to convey. Shaikh sees a fundamental change in how Microsoft and its employees views disabilities, saying, quote, "It's much more just something that every team does by default. It's no longer this thing we ought to do. It's a thing that is our responsibility and that we do. So there's definitely a long way still to go, and I'm not going to say that things are perfect. But as I look across such a huge company, I've definitely seen big strides over the years." Unquote. Game-changing technology. In the next panel, more technology leaders spoke of plans for enhanced and future products, often giving much more insight than would normally be shared publicly. Greg Stilson, head of global innovation for the American Printing House for the Blind, spoke of early research into a dynamic tactile display designed to act as a full-page Braille reader and graphics tablet. Most Braille displays available today include a single line of fixed-width Braille cells, with many 40-cell units costing $3,000 or more. A full-page display would overcome many of these limitations. As Stilson explains, quote, "The idea with this display is to basically utilize a lot of mainstream capabilities for AI object recognition, scene detection, image filtering, and be able to really focus to bring that paper textbook into the e-textbook kind of concept for blind or low vision students," unquote. This would allow students to tactily follow a book in real time along with their peers. It's what he calls the, quote, impromptu learning process, unquote. The eventual goal is to allow someone such as a teacher to connect to this text